Good morning. I think it's about time that we get started here. It's really early in the morning, so I'm quite happy to see so many people up bright and early. I'm a bit jet lagged, so it's perfect timing for me. I'm 9 hours behind, so it's perfect. It's just a small midnight presentation for me. But today I'm here to talk about our modern front-end toolbox. And before I get started, I would like to introduce myself. So I'm Kenneth. I think it's always important to tell a bit about yourself so the people that listen to you have an idea of where you're coming from and what you've been doing. Right now I'm with Ctrix. I'm with our research team in San Francisco. Before Ctrix, I was doing a startup called Podio. We were acquired last year. And I have now transitioned to our research team, trying to explore on how we can use VIP technologies to build our next generation of our product seed. While I started Podio, I also started a community called Copenhagen.js. This is the one of the few communities in Copenhagen that is focused around front-end development. And we chose the JavaScript logo. So we had a logo because most user groups don't have any logo or anything. But this is a forum where we discuss front-end development. We don't talk about servers. We talk about the issues we have as front-end developers building for the browser and building applications. And this is sort of my background. I am a front-end engineer. I only focus on the browser. I care about the browser. The server part is not my expertise. I'm coming from a .NET background. Back in the days when we did SIP, we were a .NET startup. Transition to Vodafone, also doing .NET. But today I have chosen to specialize in the browser. And that is what this talk is mainly about today. But before I begin, I would like to ask you, so I assume all of you are .NET developers, right? You are. That's great. Which tools are you using? Are you mainly sitting in Visual Studio every single day? Or is there somebody else using something from JetBrains, or is it just Visual Studio that is your starting point for everything? I guess so. And I guess like you're all using Mads Christensen's VIP Essentials plugin to make VIP development a bit easier. How many of you is what you would call front-end developers? So you do HTML, JavaScript, and CSS. That's your main thing you do. So I have a few people in here. The rest of you, I assume, is a traditional ASP.NET developer that is full stack. So doing a bit of the database or maybe consuming a few services and then building everything in the stack. So before I get started here, I would like to do a small recap of what has happened with our front end the past 5 years, because a lot of stuff has happened. This is today's reality. So first of all, we got a nice, fancy, shiny logo. W3C we couldn't use for anything, but it's good for something. It's good to visualize the movement and the evolution we have had in the front end, because this logo and HTML5, that's not just about a new revision of our HTML markup language. It's about that the browser today has several APIs available. We have many different implementations of stuff we can do in the browser. It's not about that we have new semantic capabilities in the browser, but the fact that we have access to peer-to-peer video, we have access to talk to the GPU directly via VIPGL, we have access to VIPsockets, we have the possibility to do like 3D animations. All of these things is stuff that we now have in our runtime. And the key thing here is to think about the browser as our application runtime. This is the fact today that what we have in the browser today in a modern browser, I'm not talking about IE8. If you open up Chrome, if you open up Safari, if you open up IE10, or even IE11, it's going to be even better. It's the fact that we can build applications running in the browser completely independent of the server. This is a fact. This is what you see most companies do when they do a logged-in experience. If you open Facebook, Facebook is a goddamn complex application. If you look at what's possible today with Facebook, and what most of our users assume about experience, real-timeness, responsiveness. If you go 5 years back, you would have thought this is not possible. You cannot do like chat, you cannot do video, you cannot have everything update real-time. You cannot handle these kind of things. If you look at Flickr, Flickr was a great example back then when Flickr was the hot thing. Flickr today is also a quite complicated application. And if you overall look at what's coming out today, is that we are leveraging the browser as an application runtime. We are scaling on the clients instead of letting a web server handling all the requests. We do all, let all the clients do all the rendering for us, and then only let the web server do the data manipulation. So this is the fact, and this is so the setting for how we build web applications. I'm not saying that doing stuff and doing a traditional web application server-sided, this is a different approach, but this is the fact of the capabilities and what we have in the browser. And it's just important to realize, because there's still many developers out there that don't think about the browser as something where you can run an application. This is just where I output some HTML, and then it parses it, and then it renders it. But if you look at what we have capable of, what we have in the browser, it's a complete different thing. You could do a comparison to a runtime, a .NET framework, if you should put that setting, where you have a full application framework in the browser. And us as developers, I would much rather render on the local client instead of asking my server first of how stuff look like. This is giving us a much better experience. And I think that's the key word of what we can do today. And also the browser landscape has changed quite a bit. So if I may ask, how many is having Chrome as a default browser? Just the fact that that has changed, right? Remember the days when we all were sitting in IE6 because IE6 was the shit? IE6 was really a great browser, but if you look at IE6 today, most of us is hating that browser if we need to support it, right? And then after IE or after Netscape, we all transitioned to Firefox because of Firefox, because of the developer tools was so much better. And now most of us have transitioned to Chrome because the dev tools are so much better. And to me, it's just important and to state that the browser landscape will change. Like, who knows, maybe in 2 years' time, IE11 is finally out, and it may be so much better than what's going on in the other places. So this changes, and our development browser also changes. But it's just fun to realize that we're building for a moving platform, and the runtime we're actually building for also changes it. But our application still works, at least in the modern browser world, that our application still works. And that's goddamn important. But the thing here is that we have billions of devices out there that has a web browser. We always said we've been building for the web. But actually this summer when the Chrome team and Firefox team announced that they both had implemented WebRTC. WebRTC, that's the upcoming generation of doing peer-to-peer video streaming in the browser. And when they announced that Firefox also supported WebRTC, we suddenly had more than 1 billion devices out there that out of the box supports peer-to-peer video in about 100 lines of JavaScript. So everyone can do video conferencing today in a really limited amount of lines of code. And my point here is that the web is updating, we're gaining new capabilities all the time. But also the number of devices that is out there is exploding. And the fact that we're building for the web makes it a bit easier to deploy and release our applications because it's all centralized on our own server. We're not dependent on an app store, an approval process, we can control everything. And if we look at the traditional server-sided architecture, we would usually have like a browser, we would have probably a load balancer, and then we would have a bunch of web servers that would return HTML. But as you know, when we have a lot of clients, you need to add a lot of more servers, or you need to figure out a clever caching strategy. So what about that we do this instead? This is not new. People have been doing this for years, right? So we have our browser. We have a CDN to serve all our assets. They just distribute around the world. We have a load balancer, but what we transfer from our API or the web server, if you need something specific, it's just data. The client already knows how stuff looks like, how to render it, because all the assets is just distributed on CDN. This means we have much less load on our server farms, and we can use the clients as they are intended to. If you open up your iPhone or your Android or your Windows phone, if you look at the specs and how much CPU and memory we have available in those devices, I would much rather use those and multiply that with a billion compared to having two web servers in my data center, because we can move some of the rendering logic. We can start scaling on those clients. So this is, so to say, the fact on how you can build your web applications today. And what I want to talk about is, so to say, is the baseline for how you can build such applications. This is tools, so today I'm going to mention a lot of tools. I'm going to show some of them. I'm also going to introduce some concepts, or hopefully some of them are new. If they're not new, I'm really happy. But the point here is that this is the baseline. This is what you need if you're building web applications today. You can probably do a lot more, but this is a bare minimum to enable you to be productive and build the best possible experience you have out there. And my point here is that I'm not going to focus anything on the CDNs or the server. I'm only going to focus on what we do in the client. Personally, I really don't care if you use ASP.NET, PHP, JSP, whatever you use on the server side, because it doesn't have an impact on the tool chain that you need in the client side stack. It's just two different things. Of course, you can have integration for your tooling, and you all want unified tooling. But this is how, so to say, the life cycle looks like. This is a great chart I borrowed from Paul from the Chrome team. But like today, we have a broad variety of different tools that you need. First of all, we need to do some boilerplating. We need to get started somehow. We need to have a foundation. Then we have a lot of authoring abstractions. That is for us to become a bit more productive. Like we use abstractions for languages, tools, these kinds of things. Then we have frameworks in place. Frameworks to enable us to build a solid application without reinventing the wheel, to give us some structure. And the next thing is, while we actually build our application, we have some sort of iteration workflow. We use some tools. This could be Visual Studio together with Browser Link. This could be Library Load. This could be many different things while we build and debug our application. And then the last step, or the next step in the process, that's performance tuning. That's where we've discovered that what we did, this rendering, was actually a bit slow. Maybe I shouldn't do this in the loop, or maybe that blob of HTML I got from my server that was too big. This is where we realize these things. And the last step is that we actually want to put this into production. So we have some tools to help us to do an optimization of our application. Because let's face it, the way we build web applications today, then the development build and the production build is two complete different things. We do a lot of optimization to our web applications when we want to put them out of production. Because in development, we want as many files as possible. In production, we want as few as possible. In development, we don't care about file sizes. In production, we do. That's many different things, and that's why we have built tools to help us do that. And the last step, that's, of course, deployment. And we could do deployment in many different ways. We could do like good old FTP. We can use like source control, like Git or SVN, to get stuff out. We can use cloud. We could do whatever. But that's sort of the last step. That's just the final thing of getting the files out there. So if I start about talking about like the boilerplating. So boilerplating is many things. And when we talk about web application, I think that there's no other great starting point than HTML5 boilerplate. This is an open source project run by Paul Irish. At least he started it back in the day. And this basically contains everything you need to get started with your front-end project, your web project. This is everything from how you can do feature detection in the browser, how you can do analytics, how you do icons the right way, how you normalize your CSS to ensure that the baseline looks consistent across the browsers, and all these things that we've been doing for many years in our little own way. So this is just a collection of best practices. Personally, I think there's too many best practices. So if you actually open up the source code, there's so many things combined that it can easily look really, really complex and complicated. But my point here is that use HTML5 boilerplate in your project if you want to get an overview of what is the current best practices. And then you can pick those, or you can use the whole thing if you don't want to know every single little detail. But it's a really great starting point. And I use HTML5 boilerplate for my projects. We use it at Podio just to get a notion if that something has changed or the best practices has changed, because let's face it, we all can keep up to date. There's so much stuff going on. So this is a great resource just to get started. The next thing is package management. So I think like package management is not a new thing. We all know package management from the server-side world. Like, I remember when NuGet was introduced, like, for .NET, that was fantastic, right? We had that in the Ruby community for years with Ruby gems. Good old Maven in the Java world, right? NPM for the Node community. Even Cocoa Pods for the iPhone guys, right? It's not something new. We have a repository, we can ask, hey, give me this package, I can install it. We had it, like, in Linux for years. Decades. But when you talk about client-side code, we actually haven't had any single way of say, give me the latest version of this component. And I really don't care what this component is, if it's jQuery or if it's like a date picker component that is consistent of images and CSS and JavaScript. What we have done so far is that we have went to the plugins, the jQuery.com or whatever tool you now use, download a zip file, unzip that file, put it into our source code, and then checked it in. And then probably over time we've been doing some modifications to that specific plugin because there was some issue, and then we suddenly had a custom version so we couldn't upgrade. At least I've been doing that. I'm not proud of it, but that's what I've done. But now we have two client-side package managers. We have Bauer from Twitter. Twitter did this. Yeah, is that more than a year ago or even more? That is a command line tool you can run in your terminal where you can say Bauer install jQuery, and then you get the latest version of jQuery. Or you can specify your specific version. You can, so to say, define interdependencies. So if you use one component that needs one specific version of one component, you try to install another that requires another, it will give you a conflict. If there's a new version of jQuery out there, you just say Bauer update jQuery. And then it looks at your full dependency tree and say, hey, yeah, you can actually upgrade because all the modules you're dependent on allows this. And this is not something that is new. The concept is so simple, but this is kind of the first time we have this for all our client-side components, which makes it so damn convenient because then there's no more figuring out, hey, is this component compliant with this? Then you try it out and it fails. Of course, it requires you, the authors of the different components, to update their packages, but this is not new. This is something we've been doing for years in the server-side world. We also have another one called component.io, which is the same flavor of Bauer. The reason why I mentioned Bauer first is because Bauer seems to have gotten the most momentum. That's what people use the most. And actually, like, client-side package managers is really simple. So what you have here is a JSON file called bauer.json. Here I've defined my package or my project name. This could be presentation one. And then I declared my dependencies. In this case, I just declared that I want the latest version of jQuery. I want require.js. I want a few plugins. I want SAS Bootstrap. I want Qt and JS signals. A specific version. And then basically what I do is that I just run Bauer install and see if the internet works. And bam, now it fetched all the different components from the right Git repositories, put them into Bauer components, which is now a folder I have, and I have my different components. So this is a way I have a command line tool. I can run a part of my build. I can run a part of my CI. It really depends on how you want to do it. But the thing is that I can also, as I said before, I can specify and say if I want like a specific version of jQuery. And if I just wipe my folder here. Now it detected actually I wrote an invalid version of jQuery. So in this case it says, hey, this doesn't really make sense. And here we actually have a collision. So one project here, SAS Bootstrap requires minimum 1.9 of jQuery. And you said you want 1.2.3. How do you want to resolve this? It's not magic. But at least I have a tool for notifying me these things, like we have in any other package manager. And this is really convenient, so I can just say, okay, give me that version, and bam, I got it. But at least I have a systematic way of doing these things I didn't have before. And this is yet another tool to keep you productive. There is most likely a Visual Studio plugin for this. I don't know if Mass has been doing that yet. But like once you start doing client-side dependency management this way and install all your packages, there's no way back. This is just like when NuGet was introduced in the .NET world. Now I said package managers because kind of the next thing on this, that's dependency management. Dependency management is something a bit different than the package management because now we have the components on our local file system. But I want to be able to annotate that I need this component in my code. And if I need to be able to build up a dependency graph of load, I need jQuery for this specific component in my code, just like you can say import this with your namespace in C#, then we need a tool for that. Sadly, we don't have it baked into the ecosystem yet. It's coming in ES6, ECMAScript 6, where we have a module definition. But so far, we in the community has agreed on using a tool called Require.js and AMD, the asynchronous module definition, which is just a pattern for us to unifying on a pattern how we declare our modules. So in the good old days, we just all used a closure. So executing closure, we would probably say window.example, bam, and then expose something. If I had a dependency, I would just say var dollar equals jQuery or whatever my component is, and that way I can just control my dependencies. But this meant that if I just wrote it that way, I would need to manually control the order of my script includes. So if suddenly something used jQuery and jQuery wasn't included, I would get like jQuery is undefined. This is like really, really basic stuff, right, that we don't have in the browser. Then we had another pattern called CommonJS. This gained quite popularity, or still quite popular. It's the default pattern in Node.js, where we basically have a global export object, so I can define my component and say I want to require, which is a global function I can just call, I want jQuery, and that returns my instance of jQuery, and I can use it. And when I want to expose something, instead of exposing it on the global window object, I say exports, and that way I can register my different components. That is really good in a server-side context because everything is synchronous. But when we do web and we do stuff in the browser, then we need to be able to do this a bit asynchronously. Because what if I download a component over here and I need this? And it's a bit slow and I need that component over here and it's also a bit slow. I just want my code to execute once both things are actually downloaded. So this is why we have defined AMD, which is quite simple. It's a globally defined function called define. The first argument is either a name or nothing. So here I have like, I'm not using a name, and then I have an array of my dependencies. So here I say I need jQuery, I could have a long list of components. And then I have a function, a callback function that is being called. Once all of these dependencies has been downloaded or loaded, and then the dependencies are then injected into the function as function arguments. So this is a way for me to have a synchronous way. So this code return blah 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 only executes when these components up here has been downloaded. But of course this requires like that we have a global define function and a global require function. And this is where require.js comes into play, because require.js is a small library you include on your site that then defines these two functions and is a client-side script loader. So require.js is the sort of the abstraction that makes sure that when you say require this, it's actually being loaded from the right UL. You can do configuration of that. And making sure that everything in the dependency graph is loaded. And if it's not loaded, it attempts to load the files. So this is an abstraction you can use to have like a much more sane way of annotating your code. But of course, like when you start having a big code base, you also want to visualize your dependencies. And that's some of the things that is quite common in other frameworks where you can build up a dependency graph of all your dependencies in your application, but that's not something that we got out of the box. So a bit time ago, I wrote a small cool tool called Dependo that can basically draw a graph, and then that way then you can highlight dependencies. This is just like an example project that nobody is dependent on jQuery, and you can see like this lib file is dependent on jQuery. You can see like main is dependent on these components and this controller, and the whole point is that this is a tool that you can use to visualize all your dependencies. This is also a tool that you can use to highlight if you have like duplicates in your dependencies, or you, once you draw this graph, you can actually figure out and say, so why is there circular reference here, or why is these things being included in this order? And this is yet something that is relatively new in the JavaScript world, tools that we haven't had before. But this is some of the things that enables us to gain a much better overview of our code and enable us to build applications that we couldn't build before. If you continue here, then what I want to talk about is authoring abstractions, and more specifically precompiled CSS. I hope most of you is, how many of you is using less on a daily basis? A few. So if the rest of you, when you write CSS, if you just write regular CSS and you have a big code base, usually it starts imploding in your hands. That then a new guy coming aboard having a different code style, or it just becomes a mess. So this is kind of the reason why the community started building what we call precompilers, and then also the term precompile CSS. So we've been building small authoring abstractions where we can write stuff in a bit different syntax that can then code generate our CSS, because like CSS is probably but CSS is quite a messy language, especially when you have stuff that is growing. So we've been introducing these abstractions so we can reduce some of the complexity when we write the code. We have the possibility to introduce like variables, mixins, these kind of things that we don't have out of the box in our CSS. So for example, if you have a color palette, it's just variable color. So you don't need to repeat the same hex codes like 10,000 times. And you could argue that some of the things belong to the code editor. Some things, at least my opinion is that it belongs to the language. I don't want my code editor to autocomplete all these things, because what if stuff changes? Then my code editor can then do a search and replace these values. But to me that belongs in abstraction so I can generate my output. Just like you write a programming language like C# and you don't write assembly, right? So we have various different abstractions available. We have SAS, we have Less, Stylus, and then we also have a tool called AutoPrefix that I'm going to mention in a bit. On the .NET platform, we have Less available. I'm on the Ruby platform, so I'm using SAS. Those three abstractions here is about the same. There's a bit of syntactic sugar in between, but they kind of do the same thing. There's also some implementation details in terms of performance. As far as I remember, Less is 4 times faster than SAS, but this is something you do a part of your build, so it doesn't really matter that much. But they kind of achieve the same thing. And this is my point, like CSS is probably the thing that is one of the most overlooked things when you do web applications. It's just CSS, how hard can it be? It's just a selector and then some properties. It's some of the things that most people don't take time to actually set up a proper architecture for. And this is the reason why it simply implodes between your hands. because it's some of the things that you haven't thought through, that you're just starting writing your CSS in one way, and then it just grows and grows and grows. And then suddenly you have like a million different CSS selectors in your code. And then you realize, so this layout with a box next to another box with the image and then an icon over here, I actually have that like 10 different times in my code, or maybe 1,000 different times, but I haven't made a generic module or CSS class for this. I just repeat myself over and over and over again. And this is some of the things that you need to do upfront, architecture your CSS. And also, why is it that I repeat the same font size every time? 12 pixels there, 12 pixels there. And what if my designer suddenly say, hey, this should be like 13 pixels? Then I need to go through my whole code base and do a search and replace. Why didn't I use an abstraction so I can just change the variable and everything would change? Or when the designer says, hey, this color, I actually need like an opacity of 30% of that. Then you just change that because you can do color calculations if you use the right abstraction. So you don't need to do these things by hand. Like how many of us has actually opened Firefox or Photoshop and pasted it in a hex code and then sit and apply the opacity to get the right hex code back? That's just plain stupid when we have abstractions that can help us doing these things. And this is precompiled CSS. If somebody is not familiar with precompiled CSS, this is how it looks. So here I have like a selector.slide. And what you have here is then a weird selector. So in this case, this is SAS. So what this is like, what I annotate here is that if there's a child of slide that has a current class current, then I include a mixin to do a CSS transform. This is a way for me not repeating CSS transforms in 5 different ways because the browser windows cannot agree. Then my CSS, and then I have a nested selector called autofade, and then I have another selector down here that also uses a mixin. But the point is, instead of writing .slide, .current, all this CSS, include my CSS transform in all the different ways that the browser windows can imagine, then I can just use like inheritance in my selector, so I don't need to repeat myself. Because what if I need to change slide to node? Then just into one place with regular CSS, you need to change it like 3 different places for this example. So this is some of the things that precompiled CSS can help you with. And as I said, you can also introduce variables, you can do a lot of other things. But this is just a really basic example that helps you keep your CSS sane. Another thing I want to mention here, that's basically auto prefixer. So I mentioned that window prefixes is quite a pain. Luckily, most of the browser windows, when I say most, I say Firefox and Chrome, they have decided to go away from window prefixes because they have a long tail, they exist forever. But that means we as developers, we need to deal with them. So if I need to do like a transform, I need to prefix it. WebKit transform. If I need to do border radius, luckily I don't need to do that anymore because the world is flat and people don't want round the corners anymore. But like then you need to do like most border radius, WebKit border radius. And this is like a maintenance nightmare because first of all, as developers, we don't want to repeat ourselves, right? I don't want to write this 3 times just because the browser windows couldn't agree. So either I can use my editor that probably has some clever code completion, like Web Essentials, where I just type it, press tab, and bam, it generates everything, right? But I actually think that that's not the right way of doing it. What I prefer instead is a tool where I write my CSS, I put it through this tool, and then it generates what I actually need to write. So instead of writing that, I would need to write all of this. But my point, why do I need a tool or why do I want a tool? Because then I can automate this. So first of all, the code I'm looking at in my editor is much smaller. I just want to look at what's relevant and then I can code generate the rest. But the other thing here is that I want to make this data driven. Because what happens when there's a new browser out there that has suddenly full support or full screen, that so it's no longer window prefixed? Either I need to wait for the Microsoft team to do an update to Visual Studio, I need to remove all those CSS selectors by hand. If the editor supports it, it can go through my code base and clean up the code, then it would be great. But actually what I prefer is that I have my abstraction that is in using the best database we have available, and that's caniuse.com. which is a website that has a database of what we can use in all the different browsers, how the compatibility is. So here, this is a list I've just embedded an iframe here. So you can see, like, if I need to do like CSS position fixed, it's not supported here, but there's some partial support here. And my point is that this is updated almost on a daily basis. And no matter how I write my CSS, if I don't use a vendor prefix, auto prefixer will download the database from can I use, then generate the right vendor prefix. So that means if there's a new version of IE out and I no longer need to support the old version, it will automatically adjust because I can define my targets. And this is really important because it puts yet another tool that can ease the load on my shoulders. So I, as a front-end developer, don't need to think about these things because, quite frankly, I don't. Another thing when we talk about frameworks. So this was some of the tools that I think that you need to have in your tool belt and your toolbox that is bare essential. So if we talk about frameworks. Frameworks is the area that is so highly opinionated. But I think one thing that we can be sure of with frameworks is that you need some structure, especially when you're building client-side applications, especially if you don't have a web server. Just like you have used ASP.NET MVC web forms, whatever you use in the server, you have some sort of structure. You have a framework in place to help you write your application. It's not all the good old classic ASP days where we did a bit of hacking everywhere. You need structure, and you need more than just jQuery. jQuery is a great library for manipulating with the DOM, but jQuery is not an application framework. It's a small library to even out some of the browser differences. And it doesn't provide you anything more than that. You can add a few plugins, but that doesn't really help you much. You end up with spaghetti code anyway, because there's no structure built in unless you sit and architecture it yourself. So you need some sort of framework. And I'm not here to tell you what framework you should use. Personally, I'm using Backbone and Angular, depending on the projects. I've also been working with Knockout. Ember is also a really interesting framework. There's so many frameworks out there. So it's not my right to tell you which framework you should use. And I could give like 2-hour talks on each framework. But the point is that you need some framework in place. Just like you've chosen a server-side framework, you also need a client-side framework. You cannot ignore this. You need structure in your code. And choose whatever framework that suits your application best. If you do a hybrid application where you do stuff on the server, then maybe Knockout is a framework you should use. If you go pure client-side, where you don't even need a web server, but just talking to a REST API directly, maybe Angular or Ember is a framework. If you want to do a bit of both, then Backbone, I don't know, it depends on your application. But evaluate your framework and the tools and the ecosystem and all these things, but the point is that you need a framework. You cannot live without it. If you continue here, then let's say now we have the boilerplating, we have some tools to help us write our CSS a bit better. So now we are in the iteration workflow. So this is while we craft our application, we're actually authoring it. Then we also need some tools. One tool we cannot live without because we are writing our application with a dynamic language, JavaScript. We cannot do any static analysis of the language. So we need a linter. So you cannot live without JS Hint. This is a fantastic tool to lint your code, to tell you about if you missed a semicolon here, if you're doing stuff in a weird way, if you do stuff within loops. That can basically just give you some overview of your code. And this is especially great if you have a team working on the same project and people are coming from different backgrounds. Then this is a tool where you can apply a specific set of rules. You can integrate this as part of your CI. And frankly, this is just like using FXCop, StyleCop, whatever you do in C#. It's a tool that you cannot live without. So here is an example of some code. If I do like var equals var1 equals blah, and I forgot my semicolon. I actually have a bunch of warnings here, right? First of all, I cannot use one, blah, blah, blah. I'm missing a semicolon here. There's a bad assignment. These kind of things. There's one defined variable. This is kind of the feedback that this tool can give you. And you can have various different reporters, so it fits your CI system. You can have a XML format, all these things. This is just the the design they chose on the website. But this is a tool that is essentially you cannot live without. If you author JavaScript, you should use JSHint. And then, funny enough, we also have another tool called CSSLint. Because like most of us also writing CSS, but we don't have, or most people don't have any tool to lint your CSS to actually sanity check what you did was sort of okay. If you used a CSS property that was only available in one specific browser, or you chose to do something for a block, for inline element that can only be applied to an inline element, these kind of things that just can sanity check your code. Mass has been doing some great tools for Visual Studio, but integrating this as a part of your CI to have a unit test that fails if you people commit these things, use CSSLint is the de facto standard tool we have in the community. It's used from everything from people on Linux to Windows to Mac. Use it. It's the tool that we got out there in the community. It's continuing to add new rules upon. And it essentially works the same way as JSHint. It's a command line tool you can integrate with your editor. It gives you some sort of error report that you can show whenever you want. Another thing I also find essential to your workflow, that's library loading. Library loading is not something new. We've been doing this for years. Back in the days, I did a browser extension called CSS Reloader, where you could press F12 or right-click and say Reload CSS, and then it only refresh your CSS when you sit and did pixel pushing. People have built a lot on top of that, so now we have library loading. This is can be integrated with your editor, it can be a command line tool to run, but the essential thing is that you open a VIP socket from your computer to your browser. So every time you make a change to a file, you have a runner running in the background that detects that change to the file and pushes the update to the browser. So that means every time you sit and do something in your browser, it's being pushed, so you don't need to reload your page. This is also important when you build, like, especially when you're building complex applications that has a lot of state, because frankly, every time you do a reload, you waste your time. Mass has been doing some work on formalizing this to browser link in the Visual Studio world. So check out browser link, because this is essential, a socket from your editor to your BIP application where you can do some really cool things. But this is essential for ways to be productive when you build your application. Because like sitting and doing reloads like a crazy man, that's simply not fun and just waste of time. We have tools that can do this for you. Another thing is like I would say that you cannot live without, I just need to check my time here, is Chrome DevTools. It's not because like I favor Chrome over any other browser, but the tooling is something I cannot live without. And this is just an example of a DOM inspector. Here I have my elements, I have my CSS properties. This is no different than what I have in Firebug or even have in the good old VIP developer toolbar I have like in IE 8.7. But it's all the other tools that are important. My resources, so I can see which resource on the page that loads. I can see my cookies. I can see my network timeline. I can see which order of files were loaded. I can do a bit of profiling of my code. I can do a bit of audit. I have a great console. And in this case, I also have a small plugin called PageSpeed. This is like the good old YSlow tool or competitor where we can generate a score of my application or faster downloads. But this is essential when you build web applications. You need tooling, and Chrome DevTools is a great, great tool that has many smaller tools within. Especially when you want to do profiling, and then Chrome DevTools, there's no one that can match Chrome DevTools if you want to do rendering profiling. See, why does this flicker, this animation? You actually have some really great tools built in. And this is probably the reason why most of you is sitting in Chrome, because of the DevTools. It's not because the browser's no that much different than any other browser, but it's probably because of the DevTools that we ended up using Chrome. So if you don't use Chrome, start doing it. Another thing I also find essential when you start doing testing, that's using a tool like BrowserStack. The IE team has been doing some great work together with BrowserStack, trying to push BrowserStack out. I even think that they gave away like 3 months pro account for free. But BrowserStack, that's your virtual machine in the cloud. So instead of you need to maintain your own little VM with your old version of IE or old version of Firefox, you have that directly available in the browser. The way it works is that they have a farm of servers, you remote into them using a nice little flash script that's just like RDP, remote desktop, and then you have a browser to automate. And you can switch among a lot of different browsers. You can even do like remoting of your application in running an iOS emulator or on an Android phone. The point here is that there's no need that you need to sit and maintain all the different virtual machines yourself. You should use a tool for this. And I think they even also released an API so you can start doing unit tests and automate some of these things. But the point is that this is great if you do like visual testing. If you start to do like really heavy script debugging, it might be a bit slow if you want to really profile your code because you're running on a virtualized hardware. Sometimes it still makes sense to have a local VM, but for 80% of the cases when you just want to do like visual regressions and test your application code, use a service like this. There's no point in that you need to buy all the licenses for the software if you do, and then maintain all these virtual machines and distribute them in your team. Use a service. Log in, pay like for 10 people license, and your team can use it. No matter which computer they are on, your QA team can use this to give us some sanity checking of your code. Doing other things simply doesn't make sense today. When we talk about build tools, that's sort of say the next thing here. It's good old MS Build. You know MS Build? I don't want to talk about MS Build. But we got something else. We got Grunt. So Grunt is a small build tool written in JavaScript. It's a command line tool that can grunt and then run whatever task I do. This is no different than many other tools. But there's one thing that is key, that's the ecosystem that is built around Grunt. So if you look, Grunt is a small tool that you run and you can chain different tasks. So JS hint this, fetch this, run my unit tests, clean all the files in the disk folder, do all these things that you're used to like doing from any other build tool. But the key thing here is the ecosystem. So if you have some tool you need to do like image optimization, now it's loading the list of all the different components, you probably have like a tool for this. So this is everything from doing responsive images to optimize your PNGs, to generate absolute URLs, to do like UL embedding, rewriting. There are so many tools out there that you can just handpick and plug into your build system. So you don't need to sit and spend time on doing these things. So Grunt is important because of the ecosystem and because it's such a simple tool that you can use to accomplish a lot of different things. So you don't need to sit and run them and implement them from MS Build. Frankly, you should just run your Grunt task from whatever build system you already got. You can integrate this to part of your CI. For example, at Podio, I have a daily recurring task like every morning at 9. I have a task that is optimizing all our images in our front-end code. It's not something I want to do like on a deploy because like that could take some time. But every morning, it's running a daily job going through all the images that has been committed in the source code. If there's any new ones, it runs all the image optimization, checks it in to the code base with a new commit. So every morning I know that if somebody during the day, if people in America has added new images and they forgot to optimize them, it's done automatically. All of these things, it's just small things that you can do to your workflow, so you don't need to think of it. I'm glad that I don't need to think of that. Maybe we have unoptimized images out in our production environment. I don't need to think about it anymore. The job is running. So you can use Grunt to do these kind of things for you, especially if you like do static builds of your web application and other things. So I think like Grunt is also essential to have and use some of the things from the ecosystem. Another thing is testing. Testing is also goddamn important. But like, how many of you have tried using Selenium? Oh, I feel with you. Yeah. I tried so many times setting up a proper Selenium grid and all the different browsers, and frankly I never got it like working in a really great way. It was also a bit too slow. The test runners didn't work. So luckily we have something else today. We have PhantomJS. PhantomJS is a headless WebKit instance. So this used to be the code base Chrome was based upon. This is the code base Safari is based upon. But this is a full browser that doesn't render anything to the graphic card. It does everything that like a browser would do, but it doesn't spend all the time piping it to the graphics card. So this is a browser you can remote via an API to do all the things. Load this UL, look for this element, all the things you can do in a regular browser. You just have an API to it. So this enables a whole new world of us to remote a browser, to do unit tests, to do automated browser testing, where we don't need to have a test runner that is clicking around in the user interface for real, because that's kind of the problem with Selenium, is that there's a plugin for Firefox or whatever, so actually clicking around Firefox, and you can't use the machine because it's clicking around and doing a lot of crazy things. This is just a command line tool, this is a process running in the background. And you can always record a video, you can take a screenshot if something goes wrong. So at Podio, we use PhantomJS to give us some sort of baseline and sanity check our code base. So we have an automated browser system called AutoDT. Our QA lead, her name is DT, and we did AutoDT. we use PhantomJS, so we have a lot of full scenarios that is opening up the browser, clicking on this button, logging in, creating a new user, or creating a new user, logging in, doing all these things. And then at the end, we revert the whole transaction. But this is full stack testing of our web application to test sanity check some of the core flows, especially because at Podio, we deploy almost every day to production. And we just want to continue to be sure that what we put out there is not broken. And this is a great way for you to write a really simple tool to automate some of these things. If you want to write a small bot that navigates your page and click a link, loads, wait 5 seconds. If there's no script error, it clicks another link. This is a good way of having a small crawler that visits your site and checks if there's any script errors. Or you can use PhantomJS to check which images that loaded from which domain. You can use PhantomJS to check what's rendered at the page. You can take a screenshot of the page, how it's rendered, so you can see what's below the fold, if somebody cares about that. You can do all these things because it's just a browser with an API, which is just awesome. But this is limited to WebKit only. So we also have like SlimerJS, of course, like ghosts, we have another ghost. But this is like, this is Firefox that has been embedded as a headless browser. So this is yet another project where you can use like, instead of targeting WebKit, you can use Firefox. It does the same thing. It has, as far as I remember, sort of the same similar API. But we also have a small library for this called CasperJS that is controlling all the ghosts. That is basically in a small abstraction that you can use to write all these tests if you want to write them in JavaScript. So you can do like navigation tests, you can click on various buttons, download assets, all these things, basically an abstraction where you can use these things in a bit nicer way. And you can target multiple browsers at the same time. At Podio, we use a framework called Capybara because we're Ruby based, where we have a driver for PhantomJS. We also have a driver for regular browsers, so we can flip if depending on what we need. So we use yet another abstraction. But the point is that we have these headless browsers available and we can use them. Which just makes testing so much simpler. And to be quite frank, the way I go about automated browser testing is that I don't need to be certain that it works in every single browser. I just want to have some sort of confidence that it works in my most popular browser, and that is a WebKit-based browser. So this gives me some confidence that it kind of works. There might be rendering differences, but that's a whole nother level of testing if I want to do like pixel comparison and do these kind of things. I just want to have some sort of baseline that my application isn't completely broken. And this is what Phantom and SlimerJS can achieve for you. Another thing I want to just mention here is Karma, which is a test runner from the Google team from Angular, which is, if you write your JavaScript unit test either in Jasmine, QUnit, whatever you use to write your unit tests, then we have a really great test runner that can basically open up a browser. It could be Chrome if you're in development mode, that then opens up a page, loads all your unit tests, and then pipes the result of those unit tests back via WebSocket to the Karma test runner. So that way then you can actually run your unit tests in a lot of browsers at the same time and get all the feedback piped back to your build system. So we use Karma Apodio as a part of our build. In development, it runs in Chrome. In our CI, it runs a PhantomJS headless browser because I don't need a real browser in my CI setup. It runs all our unit tests and give that result back. So this is a way of having a test runner to run a unit test in an automated way, where you don't need to think about a specific browser. You can just say which browser that you want to use, and it works. I just want to touch a bit about the future. So now I mentioned a lot of different tools that I think is the very baseline for how we do front-end development today. One trend I see when I think out is that the built-in browser dev tools is slowly becoming really, really advanced. If you look at the Chrome dev tools, they just expanded over the years. And what I see is that the browser dev tools is slowly becoming IDEs. They're becoming full editors. You have a full text editor in Chrome DevTools today where you can edit even your local system files. I see a trend here. I don't know if I like it, because I, as a developer, I really care about my editor. Personally, I use Sublime. Some people use Visual Studio. Some people use TextMate. Some people use Vim. We all have chosen our editor, and that's our home. But what I see here is that the browser windows want us to move to the browser because of it has some certain advantages of having everything contained. What I don't like about it is that then I have a tight binding for the way I author my application to the specific browser I'm testing in. And that's not the way I build my web application. I build my web application and it runs in multiple different browsers. So I need to use a tool that is abstracted away from the browser. But this is a trend. Luckily, all our browsers have something that is really interesting, remote debugging. Remote debugging is, as it says, an interface to our browser. We can do remoting of our browser. This is actually what the Chrome DevTools are using internally. This is the reason why I can use Chrome DevTools to remote Chrome on Android, because it just have a remote debugging protocol. So every time you open Chrome DevTools, they're actually using remote debugging under the hood to talk to the browser. And this is just an open protocol. So this means any other tool in the world could, in theory, integrate with Chrome. But the problem is today that Chrome has their own protocol, Firefox is having another protocol, IE has been able to do this for years. Remember, like Visual Studio, test your process, choose the IE process, and you can debug your JScript. It's been possible for years, but not that many uses it on a daily basis. So I think like remote debugging started to get a lot of attention, especially now in the Microsoft world with browser link, that is, so to say, an abstraction on top of that. It's not using remote debugging protocols, but using a socket within the browser, so we can do like these bi-directional editing scenarios and these things. But this is already possible with our remote debugging protocols, and I think that's the next big thing when we start bringing all the tools that we got together. So my Chrome dev tools can talk to Firefox, so I don't need to use Firebug. Visual Studio can talk directly to IE. Visual Studio can talk directly to Chrome. It doesn't really matter. I just use my tool I have chosen. This is my home, and it talks to my application runtime, which is what the browser is today. So I think this is the trend and what we will see over the coming years, that the remote debugging is going to be somewhat unified. And hopefully this would mean if we have a unified remote debugging protocol across the browsers, we will also see like more tooling windows like Microsoft, like JetBrains, is actually taking the time to implement these protocols directly into the browsers. Adobe Brackets has been doing some really cool things. JetBrains has also been doing some cool things with WebStorm. That's implementing the Chrome protocol. They haven't embraced other remote debugging protocols because they don't want to do that investment in maintaining so many different protocols. And I completely understand. So we need to do something about it. And I think there is going to be happening a lot of stuff in this space where we try to meld a lot of the tools together, because there's no point that if I love Chrome DevTools, there's no reason why I shouldn't be able to use Chrome DevTools with Firefox or any other browser. Quite frankly, it's just a bit odd that we have one specific tool that's tailored to one specific browser. when you open up another tool like Firebug or the built-in tools in Firefox, it does exactly the same. The layout is a bit different. It's essentially the same tool, and it's just weird that the community hasn't come together on this. Of course, there's some political things about it, but this is going to be the next thing. And if I should do a summary of all of these tools, I hope that this talk has given you some new tools. If you haven't been introduced to any new tools in your toolbox, then I'm really happy, because that means everyone is up to date and have a really great baseline. If there's new tools in your toolbox here, then start using them, because the web is moving really fast. It's updating every 6 weeks. We need to like look at new functionality we got available in our runtimes. And we need tools to keep us productive, and we need tools to keep us focused, because if we don't have these tools in place, there's a lot of clutter and a lot of boilerplate that we need to do, and we need to automate as much as possible. This is some of the tools. There's many other tools out there that you can choose, but this is sort of what I see as a very baseline. And my message is, like, if you haven't assembled a specific front-end toolbox today, you should start doing it now. You should look at all the tools you have available out there and pick the tools you need for your team, your specific project, because front-end is a goddamn complex thing. Building web applications is not that simple anymore. We have a lot of browsers to support, we have a lot of frameworks and abstractions, and we need to have tools to support this. So this was kind of my talk today, so thank you. Yes, shoot. Yeah. I we are doing testing, but I wouldn't say I do the traditional tester in development. So I'm not in that school where I write all my tests first, and I have like this quite strict workflow on how I work. But it depends on what you mean by doing test-driven development, because when you do front-end development, there's many layers of testing, right? If you do unit testing of your actual units, so all you test all your utility functions like email validation logic and these kind of things, yes, then I do unit tests of all my core logic that is actually units. We use Karma for this as Podio. We extract all, because we use like abstractions like AMD and Require.js, we can load a specific module, we can write a test, we can mock out different things if we need so. So yes, we can do unit testing, and we do so. Another layer is so to say, event testing or unit testing of the events within your application. So if you have an MVC framework and you want to unit test the event flow from your controller to your view to where it set your data bindings, then you can also do like unit testing of that. You can also do like unit testing to assert your network stack is correct. So every time you do a request that's actually hitting your server and returning the right data, we need to mock out all your data. And then you can do like the whole thing, which is what we do. We do like unit testing in our Ruby layer. We do unit testing in our JavaScript layer of our units. And then instead of doing the individual event flow testing, all these things, different layers in the application, we do the full browser automation. Where we have like use AutoDT and PhantomJS to write a scenario where I need to create a new user, I need to click on the login form, I need to create a new app in Podio, I need to delete that app, and then we have scenarios defined. And the way we've done this is using Capybara, which is a Ruby-based framework, and then we've been writing a small widget, DSL, I would say, a small abstraction. So the way I write my scenario is not like click at this specific button with the CSS selector, but it's more like login form, username equals this, login form dot password equals that, login form dot submit. So this means if I change my login form, I change my abstraction of that login form in my automated test. So I just say, okay, so now the login form is actually this CSS selector, this XPath expression instead. So in our testing framework, every time I do a new component, I also write a new abstraction of that specific component. Or if I make a change to that component, I also change the abstraction. So I don't need to rewrite all my scenarios, because that's some of yet another thing that when we start doing Selenium testing, a lot of people just start punching out a lot of CSS selectors or start adding special data attributes to the elements so you can identify them again. But if somebody's refactoring a specific thing, things starts to break, and I just want to minimize the load I need to do to get my test up and pair and get them compliant. So this is how we go about testing. And this is to give us some sort of baseline. We don't have everything automated in Podio yet, but we're definitely going towards that. And right now we have a huge suite of smoke tests, just basic scenarios, simply because we are doing multiple deploys even on the same day to production. So we just want to have a really good overview of what we're pushing out is actually working. If there's no other questions, then thanks. Remember to do this evaluation. It's a bit cryptic. I don't know if you've seen it, but something with the session code, then votes 1 to 5 and different categories, and then optional comments. And apparently I think there's a prize for the speaker, so please do it if you find this interesting. So thanks.